Disc 7.
It may be that the design of the negative studies has more to do with their negative results than bias. For example, it is known that rats require twice the dose and mice 7 times the dose of aspartame as humans require to produce the same increase in plasma phenylalanine. It is the rise in brain phenylalanine that is thought by some to cause the seizures. More likely is the direct excitatory effect of the aspartate itself. Phenylalanine may act to potentiate this irritability. In one study, the blood phenylalanine levels rose 30-fold following a 1 gram dose of aspartame. As with other excitotoxin studies, chronic exposure may play an important role in the causation of the destructive pathology known to occur with human seizures. Most of the experimental seizure studies used short-term exposure to the excitotoxin. We know that excitotoxins have a cumulative effect when given chronically, as the toxic damage accumulates with each successive dose given. One must also consider other concomitant factors, such as diet, water intoxication, and other metabolic derangements. As we have seen, some people have difficulty metabolizing certain amino acids, thereby resulting in an accumulation of toxic substances. Roger Coulombe and Raghubir Sharma demonstrated that the rise in brain phenylalanine following aspartame ingestion was not evenly distributed throughout the brain. And they point out that other experimental studies reporting little brain accumulation of phenylalanine were due to the method of using whole brain homogenates rather than testing individual brain regions. They found, for instance, that even with low doses of aspartame, levels of phenylalanine rose significantly in the hypothalamus, medulla oblongata, and corpus striatum, even though the whole brain phenylalanine levels were not elevated significantly. Elevations of dopamine and phenylalanine in the brain have been associated with several known behavioral disorders, including schizophrenia and seizures. This would explain the symptoms seen in the lady consuming large amounts of tea sweetened with NutraSweet. Of equal concern is the effect on endocrine control by the hypothalamus. As discussed previously, excitotoxins play a major role in the circuits of the hypothalamus. It is also known that norepinephrine and dopamine, both produced by the metabolism of phenylalanine in the brain, play an important role in controlling the release of several pituitary hormones, vasopressin, prolactin, oxytocin, luteinizing hormone, growth hormone, and thyroid-stimulating hormone. From what we do know, it is conceivable that NutraSweet can, in commonly consumed doses, cause abnormalities of this delicate endocrine control system, especially in the developing infant and child. As more and more foods containing NutraSweet are added to our diets, the greater the danger to ourselves and our children grows. According to the FDA, in 1985, America consumed 3,500 tons of aspartate as NutraSweet. Even more foods contain this excitotoxin sweetener today, and it continues to be promoted by a series of powerful advertising campaigns. With over 100 million persons in the United States alone consuming NutraSweet on a regular basis, these questions demand answers. And until these answers are forthcoming, NutraSweet should be banned from foods. Magnesium and seizures. Another piece of indirect evidence linking excitotoxins and seizures comes from the observation that magnesium raises the threshold for seizures, reducing the chances of a seizure developing. Likewise, experimental studies have shown that low magnesium significantly lowers the threshold for seizure, that is, makes them more likely to occur. It has also been observed that the temporal lobes normally contain rather high levels of zinc. Both zinc and magnesium, you will recall, act to block the effect of excitotoxins on the special NMDA-type glutamate receptors. Headaches. This is the number one complaint by consumers using products containing NutraSweet. As with seizures, the connection is hotly debated. Again, the NutraSweet manufacturers have marshaled scientific studies which disclaim a connection to headaches. And, as with seizures, much of the human connection is anecdotal. In a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Donald R. Johns reported what appeared to be a connection between a case of migraines and the consumption of large amounts of NutraSweet-containing beverage. It involved a 31-year-old woman with a known history of well-controlled migraine headaches, that is, well-controlled, until she began to drink 6 to 8 12-ounce cans of Diet Cola sweetened with NutraSweet, 15 tablets of aspartame and other foods containing aspartame, approximately 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams daily. Approximately 2 hours after ingesting the drinks, she noticed stomach upset and a throbbing headache. When she was taken off dietary aspartame, she noticed a significant improvement in her headaches, which eventually disappeared altogether. To make sure that it was the aspartame that was precipitating her migraine headaches, her doctor challenged her with a solution containing 500 milligrams of pure aspartame, after which her headache reappeared within 1.5 hours. In 1987, Dr. Susan S. Schiffman and co-workers conducted a study at Duke University to see if aspartame could indeed precipitate headache. They used 40 subjects who had on several occasions reported headaches following aspartame ingestion. She found that the incidence of headaches in those taking the aspartame was essentially no different from the subjects taking placebos. This would appear to lay the argument to rest. It should be noted that this study was funded in part by a grant from the NutraSweet company. But in the May 1988 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, three letters appeared which threw Dr. Schiffman's study into serious question. In the first of the letters, Dr. Richard B. Lipton and co-workers at the Montefiore Headache Unit reported that in their studies using 171 patients, they found 8.2 of the patients who had headaches were sensitive to aspartame. While they acknowledged the negative study of Dr. Schiffman, they also noted that the connection of migraines with exposure to dietary chocolate also failed to pass the double-blind study, yet it is widely accepted as a trigger for migraines. They further noted that stress and tension are also triggers for migraines and other headaches, and that the test itself is often stressful enough to precipitate a headache. They concluded that double-blind testing is not a good method for testing substances that can precipitate headaches. It is interesting that Dr. Schiffman found that 35% of their patients developed headaches following aspartame exposure, which is considerably higher than Dr. Lipton's figure of 8.2%. The difference could be secondary to the stress factor. The second letter was written by Dr. Robert Steinmetzer and Dr. Robert Kunkel of the Cleveland Clinic and pointed out other equally important shortcomings in the Schiffman study. They note that the challenges using placebo or aspartame were separated by only 48 hours, yet it is known that migraine can occur as late as 72 hours following exposure to a known triggering substance. They also criticized the study for using only a single challenge. They concluded that it was a little premature to exonerate aspartame as a triggering substance for migraine, and that persons with migraine and other vascular headaches should be warned to avoid NutraSweet. The third letter was from Dr. Louis Elsis of Emory University, who found that the Schiffman study did not measure the blood levels of phenylalanine. He also criticized the failure to perform a chronic study, which would resemble a person drinking diet drinks over a long period of time. Dr. Elsis also noted that encapsulated aspartame, as was used in the Schiffman study, is poorly absorbed, 50%. The doctor concludes, perhaps a more thorough, unbiased peer review of the clinical research protocols would have produced a better designed experiment. The NutraSweet company, which supported this experimental design, may have an interest in protocols that would find that their product had no untoward effect. I have discovered another flaw in the study, which may also help explain their negative results. They designed the study so that the subjects received normal meals for 3 to 5 days, and then, after a washout period, which I assume was a period of fasting lasting 24 hours, they were given the aspartame pills. It has been estimated that anywhere from 10 to 15% of persons become hypoglycemic after a 24-hour fast. Hypoglycemia is not only a trigger for migraine, but it also triggers its own headache. And indeed, Dr. Schiffman reported that those patients in the treatment group did have lower blood glucose than those in the placebo group. Unfortunately, the figures for the blood glucose were not given in the paper, and since clinically symptomatic hypoglycemia can occur within the lower range of so-called normal blood sugar, this information would be important. It is not necessary for the glucose level to be drastically low to precipitate headache. Some laboratories report the lower limit of normal at 60 milligrams per deciliter. Many people, including myself, will develop an excruciating headache at this level. And as we have seen throughout this book, hypoglycemia aggravates or magnifies the adverse effects of all excitotoxins, including aspartate. Going back to Dr. Steinmetzer's comment about the 72-hour delayed effect of known triggers, the 24-hour washout period would allow food triggers to appear in this study as well. So, in essence, the Schiffman study settles nothing. I recently received a most interesting letter from a gentleman and his wife who have been studying the question of MSG safety for many years, Mr. Jack L. Samuels and Adrian Samuels, Ph.D. In this letter, Mr. Samuels makes the statement that the glutamate industry has been engaged in scientific fraud as regards the safety of their product. This is a bold statement to make, but he and his wife have some compelling evidence to back up their accusations. It appears that one of the prime organizations supporting the use of MSG, the International Glutamate Technical Committee, has known all along that placebos used in testing the safety of MSG contained a powerful excitotoxin themselves. The Samuel sent me a copy of correspondence sent to Sue Ann Anderson, RD, PhD, a senior staff scientist at the Life Sciences Research Office in Bethesda, Maryland, from the chairman of the International Glutamate Technical Committee, Dr. Andrew G. Ebert, in which Dr. Ebert states that aspartame, NutraSweet, has been used as a masking sweetener in both the MSG samples and the placebos in tests conducted on the safety of MSG. A placebo is used in such a test as a control, so that the test subject cannot tell which sample they are taking, the active drug or the control substance. To prevent them from tasting the MSG, researchers had been using sucrose in both samples. But since 1978, the sweetener was changed to aspartame. This was done because sucrose was thought to alter the absorption of the MSG. Placebos are supposed to be completely inert substances. Otherwise, they would produce a physiological effect of their own and ruin the experiment. In the case of MSG toxicology studies, the placebo used to test the excitotoxin glutamate is NutraSweet, which contains the excitotoxin aspartate. It has been clearly shown in a multitude of studies that aspartate produces the identical destructive reactions on the nervous system as MSG. It would seem obvious even to the layman that you would not use a control substance to compare to a known toxin if the control contained the same class of chemical toxin. But that is exactly what is being done. Are the representatives of the glutamate industry aware of this basic scientific fact? It is hard to believe otherwise, especially in the face of the fact that one of their own representatives presented evidence before a public hearing at a meeting of the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, in which tables were presented showing that aspartame produces the same types and incidences of reactions as MSG. Did these scientists disclose in their scientific papers the fact that the placebos also contained a known excitotoxin? The answer is an emphatic no, and I have reviewed dozens of these studies. In fact, I was not aware of this deception until I received the proof from Dr. Samuels. In many cases, the powder used to mix the placebos was supplied by the International Glutamate Technical Committee, IGTC. It is interesting to note that the Ajinomoto Company, the chief manufacturer of MSG and the raw materials of aspartame, is an active member of the IGTC. This company funds extensive research programs and provides funds to major universities for research on the safety of MSG. In my personal opinion, I have to believe that both the company representatives and certainly the scientists doing the research must know that such studies are questionable, at the very least. So far, I have been talking only about NutraSweet, but what about other food additive excitotoxins? Dr. Alfred Skopp, co-director of the Northern California Headache Clinic, in a recent paper for the journal Headache, notes that while MSG is a known trigger of migraine headache, foods frequently contain from 3 to 5 grams of MSG per meal. The headache produced by MSG ingestion is not always immediate and can sometimes be delayed for several hours, especially when eaten with food. He has found that by eliminating MSG and other hidden forms of the excitotoxin from the diet, migraine sufferers have far fewer and milder attacks. I have found this to be true in my own practice. Once patients eliminate all forms of excitotoxic food additives from their diet, most find they have a dramatic reduction in the number and the severity of the attacks. I also instruct them to take 500 milligrams of magnesium lactate or gluconate daily for 1 week, and then to switch to a maintenance dose of 250 milligrams a day thereafter. I have found that this regimen works for the majority of migraine sufferers. Take the case of Mary G., a 28-year-old lady who has suffered from recurring migraine attacks for the last 5 years. She had visited several neurologists before coming to me. Like most migraine sufferers, she had gone through the entire gamut of anti-migrainous medications, from Cafergot to long-acting beta blockers. Most worked temporarily, but either caused incapacitating weakness and sleepiness, as with the beta blockers, or eventually failed to control the headache. As regular as clockwork, the poor lady spent at least 2 or more nights a month in the emergency room. Their solution was injections of narcotics. When I saw her in my office, she was desperate. After taking her dietary history, I discovered that she consumed an enormous number of foods heavily laden with excitotoxin food additives. especially MSG and hydrolyzed vegetable protein. I outlined a diet for her and the importance of avoiding particular foods and beverages. I also prescribed the above-mentioned magnesium regimen. When she returned, she happily informed me that she had experienced only one attack since her last visit and that the pain was minor. After following her case for 1 year, she reported that for the first time in 5 years, she had been virtually headache-free. I have found that the women who have migraines triggered by their menstrual period have the most difficulty in controlling their headaches. In these instances, I add fish oil capsules, omega-3 fatty acids, one capsule 3 times a day. There is clinical evidence that the omega-3 fatty acids can reduce the number and severity of migraine attacks. This conforms to the excitability hypothesis for the etiology of migraine. We know that excitotoxins precipitate the destructive inflammatory reactions within the cell, triggered by the entry of calcium into the cell interior. Omega-3 fatty acids have been shown to block the inflammatory step in this reaction. Some patients find the fishy taste of the capsules intolerable. I have found that this can often be overcome simply by keeping the capsules in the refrigerator. I would also caution the reader to take 400 international units of vitamin E twice a day to prevent the fish oil from becoming rancid. Recently, it has been shown that a class of anti-inflammatory drugs known as NSAID, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, when taken on a daily basis, greatly reduces the incidence and severity of migraine headaches. This group of drugs includes such medications as Motrin, Naprosyn, and Lodine. Unfortunately, when taken on a daily basis, many people develop potentially severe gastrointestinal complications, such as burning of the stomach, diarrhea, and abdominal cramping. The fish oil capsules work the same as the anti-inflammatory drugs, but without the gastrointestinal side effects. There is some evidence that tension headaches are related to migraine-type headaches. In fact, we frequently see the two occurring together. It has been my experience, as well as that of others, that the combined headache is the most difficult to cure. This may be because this type of headache has an element of muscle inflammation involved in it as well. One additional bit of data that seems to strengthen the relationship between migraine and excitotoxins is migraine relationship to hypoglycemia. I have observed in many of my patients, and in my own case as well, that often both tension headaches as well as migraine headaches are precipitated by bouts of hypoglycemia. On several occasions, I have had classical migraine attacks occur following a vigorous workout in the gym. In one instance, I had just returned to the office following a workout when I noticed a collection of glowing spots in the right half of my visual field. Slowly, like a spreading pool of spilled milk, the vision began to disappear in half of my visual field. Even though I knew what was happening, it was terribly frightening. I quickly took an NSAID pill. This was before I knew about magnesium and fish oils. Within 20 minutes, I was back to normal. Since that time, I started my daily regimen of fish oil capsules and magnesium supplements. The only time I have even one glowing spot in my vision is when I forget to take one of my supplements. It is important to prevent migraine attacks, since sometimes permanent strokes can result. Before I had discovered these preventive measures, I saw a man in my office who had developed the identical symptoms I had suffered, but his blindness persisted. His migraineous attack was so intense that he had a stroke in the visual part of his brain that left him blind in one half of his visual field. Excitotoxins and brain injury. For many years, it was assumed that when the brain was injured, for example, from an auto accident or from a blow to the head, all of the injury to the brain that was to be ultimately seen occurred at the time of the impact. But now it is known that most of the injury occurs many hours following the initial impact. This is because the brain slowly swells, releasing toxic chemicals into the injured areas of the brain. Recently, it has been shown that such injuries to the brain also cause the brain to accumulate high concentrations of glutamate. In one study, it was shown that brain injury was associated with an 8 to 13-fold increase in extracellular glutamate and a 6 to 17-fold increased concentration in the cortex. There is also some experimental evidence that treatment of spinal cord and brain-injured animals with antagonist, excitotoxin-blocking drugs, of glutamate can reduce the severity of the injury. One early consequence of brain and spinal cord injuries is the development of edema, swelling, within the area surrounding the injury. A recent study found that following experimental brain injury, glutamate accumulates in concentrations 10 to 20-fold higher than normal. There is also some evidence that glutamate itself can cause the brain to swell. Interestingly, it has been shown that glutamate, when initially secreted in the brain, can stimulate the release of additional amounts of glutamate, thereby greatly compounding the damage. And glutamate can promote the production of dangerous free radicals within neurons, making the problem even worse. There is evidence that a similar process develops following head injury in humans. In a recent study of 12 severely brain-injured patients, it was found that their cerebrospinal fluid, glutamate levels, remained elevated longer than 3 days. In one case, in which levels were measured for a week, glutamate remained in high concentrations the entire time. The levels attained were high enough to cause destruction of neurons. Glutamate began to accumulate by 24 hours and peaked at 48 to 72 hours. This means that the severely injured brain is exposed to high concentrations of glutamate and aspartate for a great period of time. It is interesting to note that many of the tube feeding formulas used to feed patients during this critical time contain glutamate and aspartate. In another interesting study using rats, it was found that a blood clot placed over the surface of the brain, simulating a subdural hematoma in humans, caused a state of increased metabolism in both temporal lobes. Analysis of the temporal lobe tissue demonstrated a threefold rise in glutamate and aspartate. It was proposed that the elevated metabolism was caused by accumulation of the excitotoxins within the temporal lobes. The hippocampal lobes contain the highest density of glutamate receptors in the brain. Scientists also know that one of the most common areas of damage seen following fatal brain injuries is to the temporal lobes. The pathological damage resembles the type of damage seen following exposure to high concentrations of glutamate. It is well known that brain injury can disrupt the blood-brain barrier. This can, in turn, allow glutamate and other excitotoxins from the blood to enter the brain, again further damaging an already injured brain. No one knows for how long these barrier defects persist. There is some clinical evidence that they may persist for a lifetime. I have seen patients who have recovered from brain injury suddenly get worse following a bout of high fever. That they did indeed have recurrent brain edema caused by blood-brain barrier defects was confirmed by MRI scanning. The point is that persons who have had a brain or spinal cord injury should be especially diligent in avoiding excitotoxin food additives such as MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, or NutraSweet. This is because these defects in the blood-brain barrier can act as points of entry for otherwise excluded toxic molecules to enter the brain and spinal cord. The manufacturers of tube feeding and hyperalimentation formulas must become aware of the real danger imposed by high glutamate and aspartate additions to these formulas. Strokes, ischemia, anoxia. The pathological findings seen with strokes closely resemble the selective neuron damage observed with excitotoxins. Once again, the neurons having glutamate receptors are destroyed, and those without them are spared. There are several medical conditions during which either blood supply or oxygen supply is interfered with, ischemia and hypoxia, respectively. For example, strokes, cardiac arrest, problems with oxygen supply during birth, and head and spinal cord injuries all result in either ischemia or hypoxia, usually both. In the case of strokes, we know that there is a wedge-shaped zone of brain death in the territory supplied by the blocked artery. This dead brain tissue is said to be infarcted. But surrounding this dead zone is another zone where the cells are operating under reduced blood supply, but are just barely able to function. Scientists refer to this marginal area of survival as the penumbra, named after the hazy shadow surrounding the absolute darkness of an eclipse. It is these injured but surviving neurons in the penumbra that determine the clinical severity of a stroke, for they can potentially be saved. In earlier experimental studies, scientists completely shut off all blood supply to the brain, called global ischemia, for a variable period of time, after which they would reestablish blood flow. These studies demonstrated a set pattern of changes. 1. The neurons in the zone of infarction began to increase their rate of firing before they died. 2. They observed increased glucose metabolism in these dying and hyperexcited neurons. 3. They observed significant elevation of excitatory amino acids, especially aspartate and glutamate, in the region of the infarction. 4. Finally, they found that excitotoxin-blocking drugs greatly reduced the degree of neuron death seen. In one such study, it was found that cats, made globally ischemic, exhibited a 10-fold increase in aspartate and a 30-fold increase in glutamate soon after the blood vessels were occluded. But after 30 minutes of complete cessation of blood flow to the cat's brain, glutamate levels in the brain increased 100-fold. Similar findings have been reported in other animal species. One of the real puzzles facing scientists studying strokes is the cause of the dramatic hyperactivity of neurons soon after the blood supply is shut down. A clue to this puzzle appeared almost 50 years ago when the biochemist H.A. Krebs demonstrated that glutamate could significantly increase the metabolism of both the brain and the retina. This is because glutamate acts as an excitatory stimulant to certain neurons. Roger Simon has demonstrated in his laboratory that the area destined to die always demonstrates a very high rate of glucose metabolism before death occurs. This means that the injured brain is rapidly exhausting its supply of energy. Remember, these neurons still have the possibility of surviving the stroke if conditions improve. It has been shown that this state of hypermetabolism can last up to 2 hours after the blood supply is shut off. It is important to remember that energy-starved neurons are infinitely more vulnerable to excitotoxin damage. What makes this important is that this may represent a window of opportunity for saving this zone of injured brain cells. This, of course, could mean the difference between a small, recoverable stroke and a devastating one that could result in paralysis of one side of the body, a loss of speech, or even death. To better pinpoint the cause for this hypermetabolism, Dr. Simon used a special method to analyze the content of the brain substance within this penumbra of damage. He found that during the first 90 minutes after occlusion of one of the major arteries to the brain, middle cerebral artery, there was a significant rise in glutamate, aspartate, and GABA levels. He also found that the levels of glutamate remained high for at least 80 minutes after occlusion of the artery. To confirm that it was the accumulation of excitotoxic amino acids that was causing the damage, Dr. Simon next tested animals that were treated with a chemical known to block the harmful effects of excitotoxins. He found that the size of the area infarcted was markedly reduced. Others have confirmed the protective role of glutamate-blocking drugs. Hadley and co-workers, using 12 male baboons, found that nimodipine, a drug that blocks calcium entry into the neuron, resulted in a smaller area of infarction following occlusion of the middle cerebral artery than did controls. But the sizes of the infarcts were not statistically significant. Germano and co-workers did find a difference in treated and untreated animals that was statistically significant. They found that the treated animals had smaller infarcts and better neurological outcomes. There is also evidence that other drugs known to block various stages of the glutamate reaction can reduce the size of the infarction and improve the clinical outcome after a stroke. More recently, Dr. Guoyang Yang and co-workers demonstrated that by giving animals a glutamate-blocking drug, MK-801, the damaged amount of the brain, the amount of brain swelling surrounding the stroke, and the neurological outcome of the animals could be greatly improved. This study also demonstrated that MK-801 prevented a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier that usually caused it to become leaky. We know that in cases of strokes in humans, high levels of glutamate accumulate in the brain. It remains to be demonstrated if high plasma levels of glutamate from the diet can also disrupt the blood-brain barrier, but the possibility exists. It may be even more likely in situations where there is already a weakened barrier due to aging, infection, high fever, or any one of a number of causes. I have referred to the protective ability of magnesium on several occasions, especially when dealing with NMDA-type receptor excitotoxins. Dr. S. Rothman found that high doses of magnesium could protect neurons from prolonged periods of anoxia, a lack of oxygen. We have learned previously that neurons deficient in magnesium were much more sensitive to the damaging effects of excitotoxins. This becomes important when you realize that most Americans eat diets that are deficient in magnesium. In fact, dietary studies and metabolic balance studies indicate that the amount of magnesium in the American diet has been declining during most of this century. According to a survey of 37,000 people conducted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, only 25% of people had a dietary magnesium intake equal to or above the recommended daily allowance for magnesium. In fact, 39% had magnesium intakes less than 70% of RDA. We know that stress greatly increases magnesium excretion, as do many diseases and even medications. This is especially true of chronic debilitating diseases, such as heart failure, chronic lung diseases, multiple sclerosis, and the other neurodegenerative diseases. In such cases, not only is there an increased excretion of magnesium, but often the diet is poor, secondary to a loss of appetite. Diuretics are also known to cause an abnormally large loss of magnesium by excretion. Alcohol and phosphates have been shown to significantly lower body magnesium levels. Carbonated beverages, such as colas, are high in phosphates. The ingestion of such beverages is epidemic in our society, as well as the world. I have seen far too many seriously ill patients lying in the hospital beds for weeks, or even months, without any effort by their doctors to replace magnesium losses. This is especially true with stroke patients. Even specialists are notorious for ignoring the metabolic and nutritional needs of their patients. Remember, experimental studies indicate that the stroke penumbra, that area of the brain containing struggling neurons, remains hypermetabolic for long periods of time after the stroke has occurred. This means that these cells need oxygen and glucose to survive. Also, when these vital nutrients are deficient, these neurons become especially vulnerable to the damaging effects of excitotoxins. When you add low magnesium levels on top of this, the neurons are even less likely to survive. Thus far, I have tried to demonstrate that excitotoxins, especially glutamate and aspartate, play a major role in strokes and conditions in which oxygen is in short supply. This excitotoxin accumulation is secondary to release within the brain itself and not due to that taken in the diet. But knowing that the blood-brain barrier is damaged by strokes and during hypoxia, one logically must assume that high levels of dietary excitotoxins can pose a significant threat to the survival of these floundering neurons in the penumbra zone. In addition, we know that some people are unable to metabolize glutamate from their diet, resulting in abnormal toxic accumulations in the blood, and hence within the injured brain. At present, we have no inexpensive way to determine who these unfortunate people are. We have seen that our normal diet contains enormous amounts of excitotoxins in various forms. Those in liquid form, such as NutraSweet sweetened beverages and MSG-containing soups, are more rapidly and completely absorbed and therefore pose the greatest risk. Some hospitals add these excitotoxin food additives to the patient's food. In fact, several nutritionists are recommending that glutamine, the precursor of glutamate, be added to the diet of seriously ill patients to improve intestinal function. And cardiologists in some medical centers have concocted a cocktail containing high concentrations of MSG with the idea that the glutamate will improve cardiac function. Patients on the heart pump frequently have multiple microstrokes, which would make them very susceptible to occult brain damage. In my opinion, this practice should be stopped. Hypoglycemia. We have seen that the supply of energy to the brain and spinal cord cells plays a vital role in protecting these cells from the damaging effects of excitotoxins. For example, total loss of energy has been shown to increase neuron sensitivity to damage 100-fold. We also know that hypoglycemia causes an outpouring of glutamate from within the brain and that the microscopic damage is indistinguishable from that seen when large doses of excitotoxins are given to experimental animals. When hypoglycemia is severe, the brain supply of ATP is rapidly depleted. This, in turn, knocks out the mechanism the brain uses to protect itself from abnormal accumulations of glutamate and aspartate. As with strokes, much of the brain damage produced by hypoglycemia can be reduced by using drugs known to block the harmful effects of glutamate. It is evident from the medical and research literature that hypoglycemia appears to play a key role in glutamate excitotoxicity, and that this hypoglycemia is not always clinically evident. That hypoglycemia, as a separate syndrome, even exists as a widespread clinical problem is hotly debated among doctors and nutritionists. The conventional wisdom is that it is a rare clinical finding, and more often the symptoms ascribed to hypoglycemia are psychological. When the supporters of hypoglycemia as a common disorder demonstrated that a large segment of the population had a hypoglycemic response using the standard glucose tolerance test, the critics simply attacked this time-honored test. They claimed that it didn't reflect the true conditions in everyday life. They insisted that a mixed meal be used. Unfortunately, most hypoglycemics do not become hypoglycemic with a mixed meal, especially if it contains complex carbohydrates. Rather, they develop very low blood sugars after ingesting foods containing primarily simple sugars, especially beverages. I have seen quite a few patients suffering from hypoglycemia in my practice. All improve dramatically when placed on diets high in complex carbohydrates and low in simple sugars. The old standby of a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet only makes the symptoms worse. Plus, the high protein usually contains a high proportion of glutamate or aspartate, or both. The hypoglycemic state makes the brain even more vulnerable to the effects of the excitotoxins, and for that reason should be avoided. AIDS, dementia, and excitotoxins. One of the tragic consequences of the advanced stages of AIDS is the development of profound disorders of the mind. This can vary from paranoid behavior and overt psychosis to severe dementia resembling Alzheimer's disease. At first, doctors assumed that this dementia was a result of the brain being infected by the virus. But later studies indicated that the neurons and glia cells within the brain were virtually free of the virus. The only sign of infection within the brain itself was within the white blood cells surrounding the blood vessels. Doctors knew that patients with full-blown AIDS often had severe infections within their intestines. They proposed that the dementia and other nervous system disorders were caused by poor nutrition, resulting in a deficiency of vitamin B12, or folate. But recently, researchers have found a more likely cause. It appears that the critical link is the activation of brain excitotoxins. Dr. Stuart A. Lipton and his co-workers discovered that the protein coat of the HIV virus could activate the NMDA receptor of neurons, causing calcium to pour into the cells, triggering their death. Dr. Melvin P. Hayes and his co-workers measured the levels of a powerful excitotoxin called quinolinic acid in the cerebrospinal fluid of patients having AIDS. They found that during the early stages of the disease, the levels of this excitotoxin were twice as high as that found in normal persons. But when the patients became severely demented or developed obvious neurological complications, their level of quinolinic acid rose 20 times higher than normal. Interestingly, a recent study indicates that MSG exposure during the suckling period of mice produces a severe defect in cell-mediated immunity when they reach adulthood. Cell-mediated immunity is important in fighting viruses, bacteria, and cancer. It was suggested that this defect in immunity was caused by damage to the hypothalamus induced by neonatal exposure to MSG. It is known that the hypothalamus plays a vital role in immunity. If this effect also occurs in humans exposed to MSG at an early stage of development, it could mean that they would suffer similar deficiencies as adults, which would mean more infections and a higher incidence of cancer, since the immune system would not be as efficient in fighting these diseases. At present, the source of this excitotoxin is unknown. It may be produced within the brain or enter from the blood. It is obvious that with the brain already under excitotoxin attack, patients with HIV infections should avoid excitotoxin taste enhancers in their food. Aspartame, brain tumors, and the FDA. It is interesting to note that the first experiments done to test the safety of aspartame before its final approval in 1981 disclosed a high incidence of brain tumors in the animals fed NutraSweet. In fact, this study was done by the manufacturer of NutraSweet, G.D. Searle. In this study, 320 rats were fed aspartame and 120 rats were fed a normal diet and used as controls. The study lasted 2 years. At the end of the study, 12 of the aspartame-fed rats had developed brain tumors, astrocytomas, while none of the control rats had. This represented a 3.75% incidence of brain tumors in the rats fed aspartame, which was 25 times higher than the incidence of spontaneous brain tumors developing in rats, 0.15%. The study divided the rats into those exposed to low doses of aspartame and those exposed to a high dose. In the low-dose group, 5 of the rats developed brain tumors for an incidence of 3.13%. In the high-dose group, 7 developed brain tumors, 4.38%. This indicates a dose-related incidence of brain tumors. The higher the dose of aspartame, the more brain tumors were induced. When Dr. John Olney pointed out these findings to the FDA, Aspartame Board of Inquiry, he was told that the high incidence of tumors was the result of spontaneous development of tumors in rats. That is, that some rats develop brain tumors naturally, just as humans do. Dr. Olney is a trained neuropathologist as well as a neuroscientist. He reviewed the incidence of spontaneously occurring brain tumors in rats and found that out of 7 studies using a total of 59,000 rats, only 0.08% developed brain tumors. The aspartame-fed rats had a 47-fold higher incidence. But to be fair, he even accepted G.D. Searle's references for spontaneously developing brain tumors in rats and arrived at a figure of 0.15%. This was still a 25-fold higher incidence in the aspartame-fed rats than in the controls. It was then observed that when tumors develop spontaneously in rats, the rate at which they appear begins to accelerate after 2 years of age, exactly when the Searle study ended. Importantly, brain tumors are extremely rare before age 1 1/2 in the rat. So in truth, the incidence of spontaneously occurring brain tumors would be even less than cited above. Yet the aspartame-fed rats developed 2 tumors by 60 weeks of age and 5 tumors by 70 weeks. In a collective study of 41,000 rats, no tumors were seen to occur before 60 weeks and only 1 by 70 weeks. The fact that 320 aspartame-fed rats developed 6 brain tumors by 76 weeks indicates an incredible and unprecedented occurrence. Within the final 28 weeks of the study, 6 more brain tumors occurred in the aspartame-fed group. Dr. Olney notes that one must assume that many more brain tumors would have occurred after 104 weeks. It became obvious that the G.D. Searle company was trying desperately to protect their potential billion-dollar-plus moneymaker. They claimed that more brain tumors were found because they searched the pathological slides so diligently. But they searched just as diligently in the control rats and found none. Besides, neuropathologists examining the slides later stated that the tumors were large enough to be seen with the naked eye. Because of the criticism submitted by Dr. Olney, the G.D. Searle company conducted a second study, which was designed to be more comprehensive. Instead of a 2-year study, this would span the entire lifetime of the rats, from intrauterine life to death. The results of this study can only be characterized as bizarre. This time, they reported 5 brain tumors in 120 control rats, an incidence of 3.13%, and 4 brain tumors in 120 subject rats, an incidence of 3.33%. While this was designed to show that aspartame was not the cause of the brain tumors, if accepted, the study would indicate that both groups had a brain tumor incidence 30 times higher than the rate of spontaneous brain tumor occurrence in rats. But the story gets even more interesting. Dr. Olney hypothesized that one possible cause of the tumor induction was a byproduct of aspartame metabolism called diketopiperazine, DKP. When nitrosated by the gut, it produces a compound closely resembling a powerful brain tumor-causing chemical, N-nitrosourea. The G.D. Searle company conducted a separate study to test the carcinogenicity of diketopiperazine, DKP. The results of this study were not submitted to the FDA until after aspartame had already been approved for general use by the American population. This study was not a lifetime study, but rather a 115-week study, which consisted of feeding rats their normal feed mixed with DKP. There were 114 control animals and 216 that supposedly ate the DKP. Not all of the animals were even examined for tumors. There were 2 brain tumors in the controls, 1.62% incidence, and 3, 1.52% in the DKP groups. But strangely enough, the incidence of brain tumors found in both groups was 16 times higher than would be expected from spontaneous occurring tumors. That did not make sense. So how can we explain these strange findings? It is instructive at this point to know that in 1975, the Drug Enforcement Division of the Bureau of Foods investigated the G.D. Searle Company as part of an investigation of apparent irregularities in data collection and reporting practices. The director of the FDA at that time stated that they found sloppy laboratory techniques and clerical errors, mixed up animals, animals not getting the drugs they were supposed to get, pathological specimens lost because of improper handling, and a variety of other errors, which, even if innocent, all conspire to obscure positive findings and produce falsely negative results. The Drug Enforcement Division carried out a study under the care of Agent Jerome Bressler concerning Searle's laboratory practices and data manipulation, known as the Bressler Report. He found that the feed used to test DKP had been improperly mixed, so that the animals would receive only small doses of the chemical to be tested. I have seen a photograph of the feed mix and can attest to the sloppy method used. The commissioner also charged G.D. Searle Company with failure to maintain control and experimental animals on separate racks, and failure to mark animals to ensure against mix-ups between experimentals, animals fed aspartame and DKP, and controls. This vital and telling report was buried in a file cabinet, never to be acted on by the FDA. Such poor techniques explain why both control animals and those eating aspartame had exceptionally high brain tumor rates, since they, most likely, were both eating the aspartame feed. What is ironic is that the FDA would accept studies from a company with an obvious heavy financial interest in having aspartame approved. But even more amazing is that they would depend on this same company to provide studies that they, the FDA, knew beforehand were highly questionable and possibly fraudulent, upon which to make such an important public safety decision. Thus far, no independent studies have been done to examine this vital issue. As a neurosurgeon, I see the devastating effects a brain tumor has, not only on its victim, but on the victim's family as well. To think that there is even a reasonable doubt that aspartame can induce brain tumors in the American population is frightening. And to think that the FDA has lulled them into a false sense of security is a monumental crime. While it does not prove that aspartame causes brain tumors in humans, it is interesting to note that from 1973 to 1990, brain tumors in people over the age of 65 have increased 67%. During this same period, brain tumors in all age groups jumped by greater than 10%. The greatest increase in brain tumors has occurred during the years 1985, 1986, and 1987. Dr. H.J. Roberts, who has written an excellent book on the dangers of aspartame, has collected some evidence that one particular type of brain tumor may be associated with NutraSweet. This tumor is known as a primary lymphoma of the brain. It is a particularly nasty tumor with a high mortality rate. Some primary brain lymphomas are associated with immune depression, seen with AIDS. One would expect these to increase. But there is also a dramatic increase in these previously rare tumors in individuals without AIDS. Some have suggested that the recent increase in brain tumors merely reflects better diagnostic methods. But a recent study found this not to be true. The increase is real. Dr. Roberts feels that an association with the tremendous rise in the use of aspartame products in the last decade may hold the answer. The use of aspartame has grown astronomically in this country. By 1985, 800 million pounds of aspartame were consumed in the United States alone. Worldwide consumption has increased dramatically over the last several years. It is estimated that over 100 million people drink aspartame-sweetened drinks, including a large percentage of children. In my opinion, aspartame should be banned from foods and drinks until this issue has been properly studied by independent researchers in the neuro-oncology field. Conclusion. As we have seen, there are a growing number of conditions affecting the nervous system that are related to toxic accumulations of excitotoxins. Recently, it has been suggested that even the encephalopathy and dementia seen in the terminal stages of AIDS may be due to glutamate accumulation in the brain, and not as a result of the virus itself. Glutamate accumulation in the brain appears to be a common denominator in several devastating conditions, and the list of neurological conditions either caused by or related to excitotoxin damage continues to grow. Therapeutic treatments directed at methods to reduce excitotoxin damage have shown significant success in both experimental trials and some clinical trials. Conclusion. In the introduction, I stated that the purpose of this book was to point out to the listener some of the dangers of excitotoxins, especially those added to our food and drink as taste enhancers and sweeteners. We have seen that excitotoxins can have a devastating effect on the nervous system throughout all of its stages of development, from embryo to adult. But a primary concern is the effect these powerful brain cell stimulants have on the developing brain of the infant and child, and the later development in the adult of neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's dementia, Huntington's disease, and ALS. The brain not only utilizes the excitatory amino acids as normal neurotransmitters, but there exists a delicate balance of excitatory and inhibitory chemicals in the brain. When this balance is upset, serious disorders of the nervous system can result. When MSG was first being added to foods as a taste-enhancing substance, glutamate receptors had not been discovered, and no one knew that excess glutamate could cause brain cell death. The food industry invested millions of dollars in developing the use of MSG and hydrolyzed protein. It was only after tons of these taste enhancers were being added to our foods and beverages that scientists had their first hint that excitotoxins carried a serious side effect. Unfortunately, this discovery remained buried in the medical research literature for over a decade before someone recognized this danger. And as we have seen, this toxic compound was being added in large doses to foods given to newborns and small infants, despite the fact that it had been demonstrated that it was the developing brain that was most vulnerable to the toxic effects of excitatory amino acids. They were so toxic, in fact, that researchers renamed them excitotoxins. Abundant research had demonstrated that these excitotoxins not only damaged the cells of the retina of the eye, but also that they were extremely toxic to the nerve cells in the hypothalamus and other vital areas of the brain. It is important to appreciate that many of the toxic effects of excitotoxins occur at a time when no outward symptoms develop. The child does not become sick or throw up, or have any behavior that would alarm the parents that something is wrong. When toxic doses of MSG are given to baby animals, they continue to act in an entirely normal way. But when their brains are examined microscopically, vital groups of neurons are found to be permanently destroyed in the hypothalamus. This has been referred to as a silent brain lesion. Such silent lesions are frequently seen in neurology and neurosurgery practices. It is also important to remember that following MSG ingestion, humans concentrate glutamate 20 times higher in their blood than do monkeys and 5 times higher than mice. Humans may be 5 times more vulnerable to MSG toxicity than mice, the most sensitive animal known to this type of brain injury. Not only do humans concentrate glutamate to a much greater degree, but it remains at an elevated level in the blood for much longer periods of time, exposing the unprotected portions of the brain to very toxic levels. What makes all of this so disturbing in the case of children is that the damage done at the time of initial exposure produces no obvious outward effects. But when the animal or person reaches a later stage of development, adolescence or adulthood, the damage may present itself as an endocrine disorder, or even possibly a learning disorder, autism, attention deficit disorder, dyslexia, or emotion control disorder, violent episodes, schizophrenia, paranoia. Hundreds of millions of infants and young children are at great risk, and their parents are not even aware of it. It was only through the diligent efforts of Dr. John Olney that the food industry was forced to halt the obvious use of excitotoxin food additives in baby foods. But, as we have seen, no one warned pregnant mothers that the MSG-laced food they were eating could endanger the developing babies still in their wombs. And more excitotoxin taste enhancers were being added to adult foods and even toddler foods all the time. Again, this was despite the rapid accumulation of research data demonstrating these previously known dangers and even new dangers associated with using excitotoxins in food. But by this time, MSG was not only being added to virtually every processed food, it was being promoted in cookbook recipes as well. In the 60s, it was being sold in food stores in powdered form for this purpose. A whole generation had been, and continues to be, exposed to high doses of excitotoxins. In 1969, James Schlatter, a bench biochemist working with a compound called aspartame as a possible cure for stomach ulcers, happened to lick his thumb while turning a page in his notebook. He was struck by the intense sweetness of the chemical that had inadvertently covered his thumb. From this serendipitous discovery was born a business that would reap $736 million in sales for the NutraSweet company in 1988 alone. By 1989, G.D. Searle & Company, the manufacturer of NutraSweet, had reached a profitability that put it ninth on the Fortune 500 list. Despite concerns over the safety of this new sweetener, including brain tumor induction in experimental animals, seizures, precipitation of headaches, and an adverse effect on the developing brain, the FDA approved its use as an artificial sweetener. Sales began to grow immediately. The NutraSweet company spent over $60 million on advertising alone during its first 3 years. NutraSweet hit the market at just the right time. Americans had become weight conscious and were looking for a sugar substitute, and it replaced the recently outlawed cyclamate. Soon it surpassed saccharin in sales. In fact, NutraSweet played a large role in making the soft drink business one of the fastest growing businesses in what had been a stagnant enterprise. Americans were guzzling diet colas under the mistaken belief that sugar consumption was the primary cause of obesity, but they were unaware of the serious health effects of excess aspartate consumption. MSG had come under criticism periodically from various members of the medical profession, the research community, and consumer advocates. But by then, the excitotoxin taste-enhancing business had become a multi-billion dollar enterprise. The Ajinomoto Company, the primary manufacturer of MSG and hydrolyzed vegetable protein, in conjunction with a dozen American food manufacturers, decided to protect their interest by forming a powerful public relations firm known as the Glutamate Association. The number one contributor to this attack group was the Ajinomoto Company of Japan. The purpose of this group was not only to defend and promote the use of MSG and other taste enhancers, but to attack anyone who dared to point out the adverse health effects of MSG. They did this by bringing their own scientists into any area where a serious question about safety had been raised. In most cases, consumer advocates are knowledgeable people who lack the scientific background to withstand an assault by a scientist steeped in the jargon of the pure and applied chemist. These attacks could be cruel and overwhelming, and only those with thick skin and determination could withstand the assault. They went even further by hiring their own scientists to perform studies that would seem to confirm the safety of the products in question. Sometimes these scientists were merely funded by the Searle Company or the International Glutamate Technical Committee, an offshoot of the Glutamate Association, and on other occasions the scientists worked full-time for the company's manufacturing and adding excitotoxins to the food. The bias of these studies is quite evident in many instances, as pointed out by neuroscientist and excitotoxin researcher Dr. John Olney, as well as other scientists. The attacks launched by the Glutamate Association on its detractors are often intimidating and ruthless. After all, billions of dollars are at stake. One would, from this behavior, naturally assume that the free enterprise system is unable to discipline itself, and therefore we must turn to government for our protection. But it has been shown some time ago that government agencies often become the handmaidens for the companies they are supposed to regulate. This has been shown to be the case with the FDA. It appears that the Glutamate Association has a cozy working relationship with the FDA. In fact, anytime someone challenges the safety of MSG or hydrolyzed vegetable protein, the Glutamate Association is invited to give its defending testimony. If the FDA really wants an unbiased view, it should seek the advice of scientists who have no connection at all to the manufacture and industrial use of MSG. But they rarely do. Another way the FDA works with the Glutamate Association is by yielding to their lobbying efforts to change the labeling laws so that the words monosodium glutamate are not required on food labels unless it contains 100% pure MSG. Also, MSG not even be mentioned by any name if one product containing pure MSG is only used as an ingredient in another food. For example, if broth is used to make a soup and the broth contains pure MSG, MSG does not have to be listed as an ingredient. But if the broth is sold alone, it must appear on the label. As Dr. Schwartz has shown, substances labeled as spices, natural flavoring, and flavoring may contain anywhere from 30% to 60% MSG. But you as a consumer are denied this vital information. Your only recourse is to avoid all foods with these hidden label names. And as you will quickly discover, most manufactured foods contain one or more of these excitotoxin taste enhancers. So, what should the FDA do? First, it should guarantee the consumer nutritional information by requiring the manufacturer to list all additives containing MSG in hydrolyzed vegetable protein, and do so under these names and not disguised names. Second, it should conduct open hearings on the safety of these additives with scientific testimony from those not connected to the food manufacturing industry or to the manufacturers of MSG, NutraSweet, or hydrolyzed vegetable protein or their representatives. Should the FDA ban all such substances as food additives? This is a controversial subject. Libertarians would say no. Consumer advocates would say absolutely. Actually, all that would be necessary would be to have an open forum on the subject to let the consumers decide. The problem today is that so little of this information is known by the general public. I am a strong advocate of reform by persuasion. If the general public is aware of the dangers involved and still decides to take the risk, so be it. The problem with coercion is that far too often the conventional wisdom is wrong, as we have seen in the case of FDA approval of MSG and NutraSweet. The public has grown to trust the wisdom of the government, despite the fact that it has often been dreadfully wrong. We witnessed this during the great swine flu epidemic, the pandemic that never occurred. But the government forced thousands of Americans to take a vaccination that was not only unnecessary, but that killed and crippled more people than the swine flu did. In the early 50s, the government approved the Sabin vaccine for polio. Millions were forcibly vaccinated. Years later, it was discovered that the original vaccine contained a known cancer-causing virus. The number of cancers developing in those vaccinated by this batch of tainted vaccine is still disputed. And it was the FDA that banned the artificial sweetener cyclamate as a carcinogenic compound, only to discover a decade later that the studies upon which this decision was based were seriously flawed. The same thing happened with saccharin. So, government control of our food and drug industry can be just as harmful as they're ignoring the dangers of these food toxins. In fact, a case can be made for the idea that it is the faith built up by the public in the wisdom of the FDA that has allowed them to cover up the danger of MSG and the other excitotoxins. One of the most frequent retorts I receive when I lecture on this subject is, if these chemicals are so dangerous, why hasn't the FDA outlawed them? People have placed so much faith in these guardian federal agencies that they ignore obvious dangers, no matter how much evidence supports such arguments. Americans must learn to think for themselves. A good example of how government health agencies can create disasters of their own is seen in the case of dioxin. In 1982, the Environmental Protection Agency announced that the town of Times Beach, Missouri, was an ecological time bomb. Its roads had been doused with dioxin, the most toxic man-made substance known, the EPA cried. As a result of this declaration, the government ordered the town evacuated at a cost of $40 million. All 480 acres were fenced off. Decontamination of the land was to take another 10 years and cost an additional $120 million. But now everything has suddenly changed. The chemical that was declared the most toxic man-made chemical known was recently found to be essentially safe and to pose little threat to humans. Vernon Houck, the man who initially made the decision to evacuate the town, now announced that he and others had seriously overestimated the hazards of dioxins. So how did they come to this startling new decision? It followed $400 million worth of new government research on dioxins. The point is that allowing government agencies to rule society based on scientific pronouncement can be a double-edged sword. While at times it can definitely save lives, it can also destroy them and even instill a false sense of security, as in the case of MSG and NutraSweet. Finally, we have seen that there are things that you can do to protect yourself. First, and most important, is to avoid foods containing excitotoxin additives. This not only requires skill in reading food labels, but it also requires willpower. Many just cannot force themselves to give up their favorite brand of chips or pasta sauce. Second, there are ways to neutralize some of the harmful effects of excitotoxins. The antioxidant vitamins and minerals, magnesium, the branched-chained amino acids, and zinc have all been shown to offer varying degrees of protection. One should not assume that health food stores are safe havens from these excitotoxins. In fact, I have found that many products, including supplements as well as foods, contain one or more of these toxic compounds. For example, at least one product claiming to improve memory and boost brain power contains large doses of glutamate and glutamine. Several of the food products found in health food stores contain both MSG and hydrolyzed vegetable protein. Soybean milk, which naturally contains a high content of glutamate, frequently has glutamate added in the form of hydrolyzed vegetable protein. Kombu, miso, and soy sauce all contain MSG. One natural food distributor recently sent out a flyer attempting to allay consumer fears of added MSG in their products. In this flyer, they make the statement that hydrolyzed vegetable protein is a natural source of bound glutamate and therefore is not dangerous. As we have seen, this is not true. Sports supplements and weight loss products frequently contain either NutraSweet or one of the other excitotoxins. Therefore, be especially cautious in buying products from health food stores. The person suffering from one of the neurodegenerative diseases or at high risk for developing one of these diseases must be especially careful about ingesting excitotoxins. One may reduce the severity of the disease or slow the rate of progression of the disease. Individuals at risk for developing one of these disorders could possibly avoid developing the disease altogether. At this stage, however, this is only hypothetical, since no long-term extensive studies have been conducted to test this hypothesis. Scientists are working to develop compounds that will offer protection against the excitotoxins without interfering with the normal functioning of the excitatory transmitter system in the brain. As you will recall, glutamate plays a vital role in the normal operation of the hypothalamic endocrine system, the motor portions of the brain, and the memory systems. Therefore, the perfect protective molecule must preserve these systems but prevent their overactivation. The fields of molecular biology, pharmacology, and nutritional sciences are growing at a rapid pace, and it is only a matter of time before the magic bullet is found. Most likely, one of the most fruitful avenues of research will be in finding a way to repair the metabolic defect within brain cells that prevents them from supplying sufficient energy to protect themselves from excitotoxin damage. Until then, we must protect ourselves and our loved ones from the harmful effects of excitotoxins by avoiding all foods and beverages containing these toxins.